We come to the last paragraph of One Bright Pearl. The home stretch approaching the punchline. Everyone has a copy? There's a few left. One. However, you and I, unaware of what the bright pearl is and is not, entertain countless doubts and non-doubts about it, and turn them into indubitable fodder for the mind. So this is an example of Dogen in his home stretch here. It feels to me like he really wants to just play a little bit more with characters and homonyms and squeeze in a little bit more ancient Zen tradition, which has, even in these little bits, it has all this related meaning. So this may be hard to explain this exactly, but what he's doing here, which I wouldn't have realized except for this footnote, this translation says, hundreds of thoughts and hundreds of negations of thought have combined to form a very clear idea. So the way that they're getting this fodder is this character for grass, and the phrase here is, well, first I'll read the story that this comes from. And then he's referring to this story with just one character, but we can tell he's doing that because it's related to this idea of brightness. So this is case 88 in Dogen's 300 cases. Ling Zhao is bright and clear. Acharya Ling Zhao is one of our women ancestors on our list that we chant. And she's the daughter of Layman Pong. Do you know Layman Pong? One of the, maybe just one of just a few well-known classic golden age lay Zen masters. Layman Pong, he was a student of Matsu and Shuto, I think, maybe also, right at the beginning of Zen there. And I think there was some story about one of them, Matsu or Shuto, one of his teachers maybe said, well, you're so into the Zen thing, why don't you just become a Zen monk? And he said something like, I like to, you know, go along with the flow of my own way. Kind of like, I like my freedom. I'd rather not have 250 precepts and do this thing that way. And so he was always honored as a lay Zen expounder of truth. And I mean, he was pretty radical for a layman, too. He made me know that story about how he, at one point, he felt like, you know, kind of burdened with all the stuff he had. He didn't want to just give it all up and go off to the monastery. But But he's like, we don't need all this stuff. And his family agreed because it was like a family of Zen people. His wife and daughter, as we'll see here, also constantly spewing Zen phrases and throwing mud balls. So they put all the furniture and all their stuff in the house into a boat and brought it out into the middle of a lake and sank it. Couldn't they have, you know, given it away to the poor or something? And, well, maybe they just didn't want anyone else to have to deal with the burden of so much stuff. So there's a whole record of Layman Pong that we have of it. Some far-out stories of this family. And here's one of them. So his daughter, Ling Zhao, you know, we just include her because she's one of these Zen women that we know of. I don't know if she was always just a young woman, if she got older and still kept going around and cutting through people's ideas with Zen. But it seems like most of these dialogues are when she was, I understand it, like a kind of a young woman. while sitting, I don't know if Layman Pong and his daughter were both sitting. While sitting, Layman Pong asked his daughter, Ling Zhao, teacher of old said, bright and clear are the 100 grasses. Bright and clear is the meaning of the ancestral teaching. How about yourself? And Ling Zhao said, how could someone who is mature and great say such a thing? Criticizing his Zen expression. And Layman Pong said, well, how would you say it? Ling Zhao said, bright and clear are the 100 grasses. Bright and clear is the meaning of the ancestral teaching. And Layman Pong laughed. So here's one of these stories of repeating back the same answer. In this case, it got a laugh. Sounds like a laugh of approval. Or at least a laugh of enjoyment. He didn't say that she's living in the Black Mountain Cave of Demons. Bright and clear are the 100 grasses. Bright and clear is the meaning of the ancestors' teaching. And 100 grasses often refers to the myriad phenomena of the other dependent world of appearance. All these different things, hundreds of grasses, they all look kind of the same when you look close. Each one's individual piece of grass. And bright and clear are the 100 grasses. I think I've seen another translation that says, bright and clear are the tips of the 100 grasses. This bright, of course, is the same bright as this pearl. So Dogen, as he's nearing the end here, is like, oh yeah, with that story of Ling Zhao and Layman Pong, we can't forget about that one. So how can we weave it in here? So the word for grass is so in Japanese, and this word for thought is also so. Now here they're translating as doubt, and actually I think the thoughts part is doubts, and the indubitable fodder is the grasses, but it's like they, Dogen took, Dogen substituted this character so, meaning grass, for so, meaning thought, idea, or possibly doubt, in order to allude to to this bright and clear, the 100 grasses. So that's why he uses them both here. Entertaining countless doubts and non-doubts about it, and turn them into like, instead of doubt for the mind, fodder for the mind. Or another translation is thinking of anything, let's see. Yeah. However, for me and you both, the thinking of everything, not thinking of anything which doesn't know what is the bright jewel and what is not the bright jewel, may have gathered fodder of clarity. That's an awkward one. Fodder of clarity. So, instead of clear thinking, clear weeds, or clear grass. To think or to not think 100 times about what the bright pearl is or is not, like gathering and binding weeds to trap yourself. So there he caused Tanahashi brought in this idea of maybe being like lost in the weeds and grass. But it seems like, without knowing exactly how the Japanese works here, it seems that the proposal is it's this homonym thing. So if Dogen was if you heard it orally, you wouldn't even know that he was using this character for grass. And in the sentence, it would usually make sense to just say thought, but he substituted the grass character to make this reference to bright and clear grasses. But the original story is also quite apropos of this teaching, that bright and clear are the 100 grasses of the world. Bright and clear is the ancestors' teaching. But Xuanzha's expression has made it clear that our own minds and bodies are the one bright pearl, and so we realize that our minds are not ours. Or, if we have, by way of Xuanzha's saying, also heard and known and understood what the body and mind, which are the bright jewel, are like, the mind is not oneself. Or when you clarify the body and mind as the bright pearl through the Dharma words of Xuanzha, you understand that mind is not the self. So, classic Dharma teaching, that the self, who we think we are, is not this body and it's not this mind. That it's one bright pearl, you could say. One bright pearl is a teaching of no independent self, of me or you. We seem to be these individual beings. We feel like this is me, this is us, and yet we're all just radiant light beams of one bright pearl. And our feeling of being me is also a emanation, manifestation of this pearl. Now this is, I feel, one of the Buddha's most wonderful teachings about no personal self. Similar to emptiness, when we talk about emptiness, we say all dharmas are marked by emptiness, but when we look at how the me, the personal self, can't be found, and what we find instead is actually dependent co-arising of body and mind, or in this case, a one bright pearl is what we find. So we could talk about that more, but this is also the topic I'm looking forward to this summer. class on Nagarjuna is looking into this issue of not just emptiness or and dependent co-arising in general, but particularly looking at this issue of the person and the self of the person, me, and this feeling that how is it that there's not really a me, and yet there appears to be me and you, and we feel as if this is so. So he hasn't mentioned this directly up till now, but the mind is actually one bright pearl, and the body is, according to Yogacara, a manifestation of great mind, pearl, mind, bright mind. In this case, not denying a body or a mind, but just saying there's no substantial, independently existing person at the control panel. Therefore, when we let go of trying to manipulate the mind into being the best me or the worst me that I want it to be, then we're just left with body and mind as one bright pearl. Whatever it is. We may have doubts about this, but however, you and I, unaware of what the bright pearl is and is not, entertain countless doubts and non-doubts about it and turn them into indubitable fodder for the mind. But Srinshaw's expression has made it clear our own minds and bodies are the bright pearl, so we realize our minds are not ours. Who can be anxious as to whether birth and death are or are not the bright pearl? Even if there is doubt and anxiety, they are the bright pearl. There's not a single activity or thought that is not the bright pearl. And consequently, both advancing and retreating in the black mountain cave of demons is nothing but the one bright pearl. So doubt is an issue here. And I speak of five hindrances to settling deeply into meditation, such as just obsessing about desires, aversion to what's happening, sleepy, hazy dullness, excited distraction and wandering mind, and then doubt. Doubt about various things. Doubt about the practice and the path. Doubt about whether we can do this practice. Doubt about our understanding. Doubt about whether our current understanding is correct or not. Doubt about whether our practice is on track or not. Doubt, doubt, doubt. And of all these hindrances, I find personally, my karmic disposition is such that I'm a doubter. This is one that like gets me. I don't know about the most, but over many, many years, doubt has been a big one for me. And I think that's partly why I'm so into Dharma study, because even traditionally that's said that antidotes to these different hindrances, the antidote to doubt is clarifying the Dharma, clarifying teachings. So often I'll, is this really, you know, how do I understand Zazen? I'm like, well, I'm not that clear about it. Well, how can I get clear? Let's go. Let's go to the Buddhas and the ancestors and the sutras and the, all these, this incredible wealth of doubt clarifications that we have in our tradition. Uh, And sometimes that can be a distraction to, instead of facing doubt directly, to actually, well, let's try to just resolve it in some conceptual way temporarily. So I think it's really worthwhile to really deeply investigate doubt in a kind of experiential way. I'm recalling this one time, long time ago, I was living at Tassajara. I think I've told some people about, I had this phase where I, you know, found this cave in the mountains and I would take my vacations in this cave. And I think this particular summer I was like, that seems too extra, or it's too distracting to like figure out how I'm gonna like work out my food and stuff and the cave, and there's so many mosquitoes and stuff. It's just like, let's just do the simplest thing, which is, I have this vacation time, I'll just like sit in my room. I'm not even gonna go anywhere. And for those who know Tassajara, this was in the upper barn down there, on the creek side. I had this room, and and I, in my youthful enthusiasm, I had some friends agree to like, can you guys just bring me food when they serve it a couple times a day, and just leave it outside my door, and so I don't have to leave the room. And so that's what I did for like a week vacation, and I would have to use the toilet a few times, and I just wait till like everyone was at a meal or something, and I just take a quick run over to the toilet. But other than that, I would just stay in this room, and food would come outside the door, and I'd leave the dirty dishes. People very kindly brought food and so on. And I just, as I started sitting, this issue of doubt just started growing. And maybe you have that experience, you know, we can sit and we can just settle more and more into the sitting, and even like examining these other hindrances, the sense desire is really tamed now. I put that aside for this week, and just, it's okay. I don't need anything extra. I'm not really averse to what's happening here. And I'm actually pretty awake and clear. I'm not too dull and distracted. I'm not like, my thinking's not that scattered. I'm settled into the groove here of this silent, solitary week. But then this doubt. This doubt of like, is this, even being deeply settled, is this it? Maybe you have asked that sometimes. It's like, it felt like a hindrance. I mean, we have doubt as, the great doubt that's the root of practice, as Catherine mentioned in her last talk, that these roots of great doubt, great faith, and great determination. That's a little different. I think there's the great doubt that's our energy, engine to keep us moving forward. But then there's like kind of corrosive doubt or skeptical doubt that's like, is this the right track? What am I doing? And is this clear mind? Is this really what the Buddhas and ancestors are talking about? And, the doubts get more and more subtle in my experience, but there's still this gnawing doubt, and it's actually suffering. It's not just relaxed with what's happening, because it's like questioning, is this, like, I don't know about this. It's not content, right? It's not satisfied completely. Maybe there's something more, maybe there's something deeper. So I just remember, okay, so I can see this doubt thing's been going on for years. Like, let's just really look directly at it. It's almost like the content of the doubt could kind of like move around and go different places. But like, maybe it's not really about the content. Let's just look at this doubting mind, this aspect of the mind that just likes to doubt, that just doesn't want to just like settle that one final like I refuse to just completely settle until I resolve something or other. And it's like, I think a kind of a clue is that it wouldn't always be the same thing. It would be doubt about something or other, something related to practice usually, and about related to meditation and practice. So I just tried to get really, really intimate with this, with the doubt, the doubting mind, and look into it and investigate, like, what is behind this? What is it really based on? And at one point, going, you know, deeper and deeper into it, and like, okay, let's overturn another layer. What's behind, you know, what's it really the core of this doubt? And like, there wasn't anything there. Like, it wasn't doubt about anything in the end when it was about stuff on the surface, but further and further down into it, it's like, it was just like energy. Mind energy manifesting in this form of doubt. And there wasn't any, like, substance to it. There wasn't like, oh, there's this issue that I have to resolve. It was like, I could even say it was like this subtle kind of restlessness of the mind that was taking the form of doubt because that's my karmic disposition. How wonderful to see that for a moment, that, like, it's just, in a way, it's like the one bright pearl, you know, manifesting as doubt. Yes, Johnny.
The story about the cave and sneaking off to the bathroom and no one was looking, I think, is implicit here. When it talks about indubitable fodder for the mind, fodder is gathered grass to feed the animals. Animals, ruminants in particular, are always chewing the fodder.
Mm.
It occurs to me that the doubt you're talking about is the digestion of the nutrient. And what may be called the doubt, that is the object of doubting, is really, what do we do with the excrement? What do we do with what is not nutritious? What do we do with what is left?
The byproducts.
The byproducts. So, the doubting is, and what we're feeding is the bright pearl. We can't tell from the excrement what's missing. We just know it's different than what went in. But we have to care for that. If we don't care for that in some way, we can get ill and soil our environment and all that kind of stuff. So,
care for the excrement?
We have to care for the excrement.
How would you recommend caring for it?
I think we just have to be compassionate. I think compassion is caring for the excrement.
Yeah.
And we can criticize it. We can hate it. We can do all this kind of stuff that is awful. Or we can just care for it. We can put it in a place where it can compost, where it can rejuvenate, it can do something, and it can come back as grass.
And by being compassionate with it and caring for it, then it actually starts to settle down more. If we're resisting it and kind of cruel to it, right, then it's kind of just, it keeps barking at us. But actually, if we're, oh, it's okay, you little byproduct, you little fodder, you little doubt, it's okay, you can be here. And then there could be this further step too of, now that you're really settled here, now I'm going to take a good look at you. What are you anyway? You little pile of grass tips.
It will be in the spring. It'll be recycled, it'll come back. So what we ruminate upon is actually the transformed excrement of the ancestors. It's recycled back, so it's constant rumination. We get hungry again. So that's what I hear as you said here. We can't really see the black pearl. We don't know, or the bright pearl. We don't know how it gets nourished. We don't know what is taken from the activity of the mind. approach that with compassion, and we care for that which we cannot use at the moment, we will be renewed in the springtime.
And these things come and go, doubts and anxieties and peacefulness and doubts and anxieties and peacefulness and other grasses will come and go as the bright pearl continues to shine, and compassionately receiving what comes, and just continuing, and then watching what grows in the spring, which we don't have to make grow. Yes. Suddenly shifted from like, why can't I get rid of it, to where is it? And then, of course, it's gone.
What kind of bliss was that?
It was referred to as the Dakini bliss.
Dakinis are like these, in Vajrayana, there's like female protector, or there's dakas that are male too, but kind of like protector spirits, but like tantric protector spirits. Not exactly dharma protectors, but they're like kind of awakened invisible beings that like support our practice. Interesting.
Hearing somebody else describe it just sounded something I could relate to as a human.
Yeah, that we have just these karmic tendencies to create these states, and partly we have the tendencies because often they do have a basis, or maybe we have them and then we just look for the nearest basis to attribute the anxiety to.
That basic teaching is a huge teaching of hers. For me, it's been so helpful, and it's like immediately drop the content. Mm-hmm. You can't even waste time on the content. Mm-hmm. Drop the content, and then stay with the energy and vibe.
Uh-huh. It's so hard because like the way we're wired is around anxiety or doubt or something like that. It's all about, we think it's all about the content. Or things, like we get into blaming others or ourselves, and all these stories that create the energy. And I think sometimes the stories create the energy. Sometimes it's like there's the energy, and then we need a story to go with it because that's how we work. And then we get obsessed with the content and forget the experience. It's so very, very common thing, and it's very hard to just forget the content, right?
The medium is the message.
What's that from?
It's Marshall McLuhan. He's talking about like television and the print and all these kinds of media.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically said that ignore the content. It's the medium itself which is carrying the message.
Which we could apply also to the world of Zen, like say ritual. The medium is the message. It's like, well, what's the meaning of this ceremony? Well, we just enact it. We just do, it's the meaning is in the doing. And as we talked about this morning, this issue of we can feel depressed if we feel like our life is meaningless, but then to turn that a little bit and be like, accept the meaninglessness and be like, okay, now let's just like live our life really wholly and completely as the, you know, ungraspable bright pearl without any like meaning that gives us a kind of a comfortable thing to hold on to. Meaning is very comfortable.
Well, yes, meanings and beliefs and narratives, in my view, are all attempts at containing and isolating the feeling that we're having.
Mm.
So it's this thing. It's this thing.
Mm.
And ultimately that doesn't work. It's suffering because it creates a barrier. It creates an isolation which is not true.
Mm.
So what you're saying is, if you get rid of the content of it, it metabolizes and causes the transformation by itself.
Mm.
And so we get distracted when we attach an idea or a feeling or meaning or belief to it. We get distracted and we suffer there. So this is very fascinating. Who was the person?
Emma.
Emma. Yeah. Yeah, that she would talk about just releasing the content and then continuing the transformation.
And I think maybe not even necessary to like get rid of the content, but like shift our attention, release it, and kind of focus more on like the energy, and then it is released. And if we can do that completely enough, maybe the content actually just ceases, but the energy continues, and then maybe the energy grabs onto some other content, and then we see that's kind of this experience with the doubt. I realized that the content kept shifting, but the doubt energy was still there, and which was kind of this clue that like maybe it's not really about the content.
So it's all references of the imputational, really, what we're talking about. We get stuck in that and say this is real.
You could say the content is like the imputational. Yeah, and if we like release that content, then there's just the energy soup of the one bright pearl, other dependent character. Yeah, I think it's to map these things up exactly one-on-one, maybe they're not exact correlations, but I think that's the nice thing about these three characteristics is it can appear in all these myriad forms related to that. So I think this very discussion, about the content versus the kind of anxiety that we think is the content. And we see that actually the content is not adhered to the anxiety. And when they get adhered, that's when it grows, too, right? That's when it feeds itself. I'm like, no, this really is, really, like, because this is how I feel, and then we feel stronger this way, and like, that's because this, And meanwhile, if we just kind of see that gap of the thoroughly established, where, the absence of the absence of the content in the anxiety, how about that?
So if we just, we can't negate the imputation, we just relax.
Mm-hmm.
And that opens us up to being able to simultaneously be aware of the other two characteristics.
Yeah. We relax it, and when we relax it, we see that it's not strongly adhering to the actual experience of what we could call anxiety.
It's in the process of transformation through some independence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that then anxiety, if anxiety is not stuck to the content or the story, then the anxiety can be seen as this one bright pearl. There's not a single activity or thought that is not the bright pearl. And consequently, both advancing and retreating in the Black Mountain Cave of Demons is nothing but the one bright pearl. And none of the notes make this connection, but because they're using the same characters here, I wonder if there's a connection to the Sandokai, the merging of difference and unity, where it talks about forward and backward steps and walking, right? Light and dark are relative to one another. That's what made me think of it too, like, how could he not bring in this because we're talking about the bright light pearl and the dark demon cave. Light and dark are relative to one another. They're interdependent. They're not separate. Like forward and backward steps in walking. Actually, this clearly who did that translation that we chant of merging our difference in unity says here, since it's not action or thought caused by something existing, which is not the bright jewel, the simple fact is that forward steps and backward steps in the ghost cave, in the mountain of darkness, are just one bright jewel. Therefore, forward or back, your every step in the demon's cave is, in the black mountain, is just one pearl. So, both forward and back also has a sense of going forward into the dark demon cave and then like trying to get out of it, all that stuff, all our relations to it. Mm-hmm.
A question about forward and backward step. Isn't there a translation of that says the front and back foot?
Yeah.
It's so different.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's like the, you know, the two truths are like walking like this and like, oh, it's all just ultimate, it's all just the thoroughly established. No, actually it's dependent co-arising. No, it's emptiness, it's dependent co-arising, emptiness, dependent co-arising. So that's, again, that emptiness and dependent co-arising are like forward and backward steps, or the front and back foot in walking. And also, it's the same character that's used at the end of that Sandokaya where progress is not a matter of far or near. It's like going forward, like walking forward is not a matter of far or near. So that's connects nicely here too, right? That because it's talking about all our doubts and anxieties and our wish to live in the one by pearl and not so much in the dark demon cave, right? going forward in practice, you could say, it's actually not a matter of far or near, it's not a matter of getting more bright and less dark. But if we're confused, or, you know, if we think that we're stuck in the dark demon cave, then mountains and rivers seem huge obstacles. Everything's blocking our way. But if we're not confused, then mountains and rivers are beautiful scenery, not blocking our way. Both advancing and retreating in the Black Mountain Cave, you know, into it, out of it, trying to progress in our practice, feeling like we're not progressing. All of that is nothing but the one bright pearl. Therefore, forward or back, your every step in the demon's cave in the Black Mountain is just one bright pearl. And that's the final sentence actually feels like a punchline to me. That may be my favorite sentence. Maybe just because we just now read it. But it kind of sums it all up, doesn't it? There's not a single activity or thought that's not the bright pearl, period. Like after all this, all our thoughts and activities, all our thoughts about this, and our confusion about this essay, none of that is not the bright pearl. And then to bring up this cave of demons, whatever it is, in the end, that messing around in that cave is itself total brightness. Is there anything further that needs to be said? Or it looks like, did Rob bring in a reference to the Bright Pearl?
Oh, I just, this was what we were talking about this morning when we were into the suchness realm.
Mm. Oh yeah, such, mm-hmm.
And Dogen, bringing up Dogen's use of suchness, so this is another reference to this in the Korakuen.
Mm-hmm.
A short Dharma Hall discourse here that starts off, since I attained Buddhahood, I always remain here expounding Dharma.
You know what that's from?
Lotus Sutra.
Mm-hmm. That we chant on Tuesday mornings.
Don't say that in our school there are no words and phrases. Truly, I am the third son of Zhi.
That's Renshaw, right? Well, maybe not.
I'm not sure.
Mm.
All dharmas dwell in their dharma positions. Forms in the world are always present. Wild geese return to the north woods and orioles appear in early spring. Not having attained suchness already, suchness is attained. Already having attained suchness, how is it? After a pause, in the third month of spring, fruits are full on the Bodhi tree. One night, the blossom opens and the world is fragrant.
Sweet.
Yes.
Sweet, the fragrant blossoms. Since you are such a person, how is such a thing?
Yeah, and I just saw that correlation with, at the very beginning of this, where he's saying, I don't remember exactly the wording, but when he's saying, you know, the whole world, the whole universe is one bright pearl.
Mm-hmm.
What is there to understand?
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just, I saw these two things correlating here with the suchness.
It's not a matter of something to attain in the future,
right,
or through understanding.
Already, not having attained suchness, already suchness is attained. having attained suchness, how is it?
Mm.
What's it feel like? What is it?
Yeah, not yet. Believing that we're living in one bright pearl. Already we're living in one bright pearl. Living in one bright pearl right now, how is it? It's dark like a demon cave.
Is this letting go of the content that you were about to tell me? I mean, that's our practice.
Huh. Letting go of the content.
Letting go of the content. Oh, always. Over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finding myself in this imputational, you know, thing bouncing back and forth in my mind. Just let it go.
Yeah.
Content. Just like can tell.
Not believing our thoughts. So challenging in, maybe every situation, but particularly when it's like we're asked to think about something. Zazen's very nice because no one's asking us to think about anything, so that's why it's so great. We have such a practice. Since we have such a practice, why worry about such a thing. At just such a time, how is it? The assembly was silent. And he said, "Happy birthday!" We dedicate any merit gathered from this Genzoe Sesshin, stepping forward and back in dark demon cave, to the benefit of all beings. May they thoroughly enjoy their life, free from content, and dance with the bliss of the Dakinis in one bright pearl. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Beings are